honored this morning to welcome Rabbi Arya Leibowitz, who's the director of Smicha at Shivat Rabbeinu Tzvachanan at Reitz. He's the Marad Atra of Beit Knesset, North Woodmere. Served as a Rebbe at Landers College for men. He was a Rebbe at DRS, Yeshiva High School. He grew up in the Five Towns. He learned Yeshivat Kerem B'Yavne, and his degree is from Cy Sims School of Business. Majored in finance, in an alternate career, never know. But we hope not, because those of us who have been zochen to learn the Torah of Rabbi Leibowitz, whether those who participated in the Daf Shir this morning, we were zochen to hear from him in person, those who listen on the app, whether his many, many shiurim, legendary shiurim on YU Torah, or having heard him in person, have read his articles, perhaps, in the Journal of Halakha Contemporary Society, or perhaps having participated in Shiurim at Shaarei Tefillah in Lawrence, or perhaps having learned one of his several Sfarim, Hakunei Olamo, the third of which I'm zochet to own on Chod Shabbat. Please, without further talking to us today about the secret of the secrecy of Purim, please do Kavod LaTorah HaRav.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Bereshus, the Marad Atra of Engel. First of all, I'll get you the other two, Bli Neder, the other two Sfarim. Did I say something to offend Jeremy? I mean, I didn't even speak yet. But I would like to thank the entire Geller family for inviting me to join with you this morning, particularly to Mark and Debbie for their wonderful hospitality. I got in very late last night, and Mark stayed up very late to be able to greet me, and I appreciate the wonderful warm hospitality, and of course a happy birthday to Steve as well, and Barbara, the sister-in-law, and thank you to Beth and Brad as well. And you know, when I came in this morning, Mark said to me, "You have to meet my mom." And he pointed to the other side of the shul, and he said, "There's my mom." The thing is, there were six women on the other side of the shul, and they all looked about Mark's age. So I couldn't tell. I said, "Well, which one is your mom?" He said, "My mom, right there." And they all looked the same age. I couldn't. So, Kenai Nahara, Mrs. Geller, you should continue to have that youthful vigor in good health and enjoy much nachas from all of your children, grandchildren, and great grandchildren for many, many years in good health. It is an honor to be participating in this Yahrzeit commemoration for Howard Geller. Let me just make sure I get the Hebrew name correct. Chaim David ben Yehuda Leib, Zichrono Levracha. And what I want to share with you is an idea that is one of my favorite ideas relating to the Megillah. It is not my own idea, and it could be taken to a certain extreme that, frankly, I'm not even super comfortable with, but I think it's a fascinating idea, and I think it's something worth thinking about. It's something worth contemplating, at least. So let me describe to you what we're going to do over here. I'm going to pose three questions about the Megillah and Purim in general. Three questions. We're then going to share one basic yesod, one basic idea. That's going to go answer the three questions, and then we'll hopefully wrap it up with a nice message. So that way you'll be able to know how far in we are. Like, if we're only up to question number two, you know you still got a while to go, right? You'll be able to track where we are. Three questions, idea, answering three questions, and then hopefully wrapping up with what I hope will be a meaningful message. Let me first introduce you to a historical figure. There was a man by the name of Rav Shlomo Alkavitz. I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I've only ever read the name. Rav Shlomo Alkavitz was known. Let me tell you what his second most famous work is. His second most famous work is a book called Manos Halevi, which is a commentary on the Megillah, a midrashic commentary on the Megillah. His most famous work, anyone know, his most famous work was Licha Dodi. So his second most famous work was second by a wide margin, right? I mean, Licha Dodi is much more well known than his Medrash Manos Halevi, than his commentary on the Megillah. And if you've ever heard the Manos Halevi quoted, if you've ever heard an idea from the Sefer Manos Halevi that was written by Rav Alkavitz, I could tell you which idea it was. In fact, I could tell you the whole shiur you probably heard that was built around that idea. If anyone here has ever heard a shiur on the topic of Mishloach Manos, I will summarize. One of my superpowers is I can summarize that shiur in 60 seconds. Ready? You want to hear the shiur you've heard 1,000 times, and I'm sure Engel has given 1,000 times, about Mishloach Manos? Here's the shiur. Why do we give Mishloach Manos? Well, the Trumas Hadeshen says we give Mishloach Manos in order to provide other people with the meal that they're going to need for Su'udas Purim. But the Manos Halevi disagrees. He says we give Mishloach Manos because Haman said that the Jewish people are Mefuzar, Umufurad, that we don't get along with each other. So to show that we indeed do get along with each other and that we know how to cooperate with each other and express love to each other, we give gifts, we give Mishloach Manos. Well, what's the difference whether we're giving a gift and we're giving the Mishloach Manos to provide a Su'uda, or whether we're giving the Mishloach Manos just to show that we love each other? Well, there may be 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 nafkaminas, depending how long the shiur is. And that's how the shiur goes. So all these differences between those two possible models. That's what you've heard from the Manos Halevi in your lifetime. In all likelihood, you never heard anything else from the Manos Halevi. Sometimes people are known by like one comment. And it's a little curious because, as Rabbi Rav Asher Weiss once commented, if Rav Shlomo Alkavitz was sitting in the room when that shiur was being given, and he heard that on the one hand, the Trumas Hadeshen has an opinion in halacha as to why it is that we give Mishloach Manos. Keep in mind, the Trumas Hadeshen is a sefer that is quoted on almost every page in Shulchan Aruch. It is about as important a halachic work as ever existed. The Trumas Hadeshen has one opinion as to halachically why we give Mishloach Manos. If Rav Shlomo Alkavitz were to hear me or you or anybody else say, and Rav Shlomo Alkavitz disagrees and he has a different halachic opinion as to why we give Mishloach Manos, Rav Shlomo Alkavitz would say, what, me? I wasn't even talking in halacha. I wrote a book of a commentary on the Megillah. It wasn't meant to be a halachic statement. It wasn't. I was just trying to explain the psukim in the Megillah. I wasn't telling you a halacha one way or the other. That's not the purpose of my book. But be that as it may, many Gedolei Torah throughout the generations took it as a halachic statement, whether it was meant as such or not meant as such. Now, the reason I'm highlighting that is the following. Rav Alkavitz wrote this sefer called Manos Halevi, but that's not really the full name of the sefer. It's not called Manos Halevi. It's called Medrash Manos Halevi. Medrash Manos Halevi. Why does he call it Medrash Manos Halevi? And he explains. He says, in my opinion, the Megillah, unlike any other sefer in Tanakh, cannot and ought not be studied lefi pshuto shel mikra, based on the simple reading of the psukim. You see, throughout the rest of Tanakh, any other book you want to read of the Chaf Dalet Sifrei Tanakh, of the 24 great books of our Bible, you can open up the book, read the psukim, just read what the verses say, one right after the other, and come to an understanding that is meaningful, that is impactful, that is powerful. Is it the greatest depth of understanding? No, of course not. For that you need Torah Shebal Peh, for that you need commentaries, but at least reading the simple understanding of the psukim is valuable, it's worthwhile, it is good. Says Rav Shlomo Alkavitz, not the Megillah. The Megillah should not be understood at face value. It should not be understood by reading Pshuto Shel Mikra, an extreme statement. And that's why he calls his commentary Medrash Manos Halevi, because that's the only way to understand the Megillah. And my first question is, why? Why would the Megillah be different than all of the rest of Tanakh? The whole rest of Tanakh, it's okay to learn it the way it's presented. And that focus on drash by the Megillah is not Rav Shlomo Alkavitz's invention. He takes it to an extreme that you're not even supposed to look at Pshuto Shel Mikra. That's an extreme. But the idea that there's an emphasis on a deeper level of interpretation, there's an emphasis on Torah Sheba'al Peh in the Megillah, is not his own invention. I don't know of another book in Tanakh where the Gemara takes, I don't remember how many, 6 or 7 long dapim in a row in the end of the first parak of Masechta Megillah, 6 or 7 long dapim in a row, and all it does is it takes a pasuk and interprets according to the drash, according to the Torah Shebaal Peh, another pasuk, and just goes through the Megillah, pasuk by pasuk, one after the other. It's unprecedented. It's not duplicated anywhere else in Shas, other than in Masechta Megillah, about this one book in Tanakh, about Megillas Esther, where the Chachamim of the Gemara, the Chachmei HaTalmud, were focused on providing us with the Torah Shebaal Peh, verse by verse in the Megillah. You have something close in the end of the first parak of Masechta Basra with Sefer Iyov, but it stops after like 3 psukim. You know, it goes for a little bit. If it went through the whole Sefer Iyov, Basra would be really long. But only in Masechta Megillah you have it. It's unprecedented. This emphasis on Torah Shebaal Peh in the Megillah. So what are we to make of that emphasis? And I'll tell you something else. If you were to look around at the Midrashim, you know, there are all sorts of Midrashim that come from all sorts of different places, but there are probably more Midrashim on Megillas Esther than there are on just about any other Sefer in Tanakh. It's a disproportionate emphasis on Medrash. So whether we take it to the extreme that Rav Shlomo Alkavitz took it to, or we don't, it is undeniable that there is a significant element of Torah Shebaal Peh, a significant emphasis, rather, on Torah Shebaal Peh in the Megillah itself. So that was a long way to ask my first question, right? So the first question is, why the emphasis on Torah Shebaal Peh? Why the seemingly undue emphasis on Torah Shebaal Peh in the Megillah? A second question. Who is the heroine of the Megillah? Esther, right? Obviously. And what's her name? Esther. We just said it, right? It's even called Megillas Esther, right? You can't go. It's got to be Esther. Not so pashut. The Gemara has a machlokas, what her name actually was. See, Esther might have been a nickname. It's a machlokas, what her name actually was. What's the other option? Hadassah. So we have two possibilities. It's either Esther or it's Hadassah. So how many opinions are there going to be in the Gemara if there are two possibilities about what her name actually was? Three, of course, because we are Jewish after all. So the Gemara in Maseches Megillah on Daf Yud Gimel tells us the following. Rabbi Meir Omer, Esther Shema. Rabbi Meir says, trust it. It calls her Esther. Her name is Esther. V'lomen nikra Shema Hadassah. Why is she sometimes referred to as Hadassah? Al shem hatzadikim shenikru'u hadasim. Because tzadikim are often referred to as a hadas, as hadasim. And since she was a tzadikas, by all accounts, so she's referred to as hadasa. Wonderful. That's one opinion. Rabbi Huda Omer, hadasa shema. No, her name is really Hadassa. V'lama nikre shema Esther. Well, if her name is Hadassa, why do we call her Esther throughout the Megillah? Al shem shahaisa Masteres Devareha, because she was unusually secretive. And Esther means to be a person who keeps secrets, right? There are some people you know you can trust to keep a secret, and there are some people who you definitively know that you cannot keep a secret. Sometimes you want to get the word out, you tell certain people, this is a secret, and then tell it to them, and you can be sure that the whole world will know about it. Esther was phenomenal at keeping secrets. Masteres Devareha, Shenemar, Ein Esther Magedes Esama. Esther never revealed who she was, where she came from, what nation she emerged from. In fact, the Gemara says she was Matzachain. Everyone thought she had a certain grace, and because people like someone who's like them. People feel a kinship with someone who's similar to them, of a similar background. And everyone thought Esther belonged to them. You know, it reminds me of Rabbi Emanuel Feldman wrote an essay once about the funeral of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And at the Levaya of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, there were Jews of every stripe that came to the funeral. There were people with kippot zrukot, and people with strimels, and people with, every stripe of Judaism. And people could be overheard saying, I understand why all the people with the kippot zrukot are here, but what are all these yeshivish people doing here? And people with the strimels, I understand what we're doing here. What are all these other people doing? Because everyone saw in Rav Shlomo Zalman someone that they can relate to. Esther had that kind of chen, but even broader, because it extended obviously far beyond the Jewish world, right? If there were Jews in, if there were non-Jews in Paras, they said she's one of ours. If there were Greek non-Jews, she's one of ours. If there were people from Spain, she's one of ours. She must have had like a very exotic look, you know, some sort of combination of different looks that everyone was able to claim her as their own, and she was able to be secretive about what she actually was, about who she actually was. She didn't do one of those, what do they call it, 23andMe, you know, where I am Native American but she didn't do any of that, but somehow she was able to be secretive, and that's why she was called Esther. That is opinion number two. So opinion number one was her name is Esther. Opinion number two is no, her name is Hadassah. She's only called Esther because she was so good at keeping secrets. And then there's a third opinion. Rabbi Nechemia Omer, you're wondering, what could the third opinion be? It's either Esther or Hadassah, right? Rabbi Nechemia Omer, Hadassah Shema. Her name is Hadassah, so I agree with the second opinion, except I have a different understanding of why she was called Esther. V'lama nikreis Esther, why is she called Esther? Shahayu umos ha'olam korin alsa al shum estaher. That the nations of the world called her by the name of the moon. Meaning they saw the moon, they saw Esther, they saw a resemblance, and they said, we're going to call her the moon lady. What? What exactly does that mean? Meaning, is that even like, I'm not up on poetry and, you know, is that even something that we, you know, someone walks into a room and, you know, you say, they're like a ray of sunshine. You ever hear someone say, they're like a ray of moonlight? I mean, like they're muted? I mean, what exactly are we saying about a person that they remind you of the moon, their face looks like a piece of cheese? What exactly are we trying to say about a person when you say that they remind you of the moon exactly? What exactly is that? According to the latter two opinions, that her name was Hadassah, we have even a more fundamental problem. The Megillah insists, beginning to end, on calling her Esther, which is a nickname. I have news for you. It's usher to do that. You're not allowed to call people by nicknames. It robs them of their identity. Very often, it's something that people find offensive. And the Megillah throughout calls her by a name. That's not really her name, according to two out of the three opinions. And especially, if you hold like that last opinion, that where did she get the name Esther? Umos Ha'olam called her Esther. What does that mean? It was a nickname not given to her by her parents when she was a little kid, by an older sibling who couldn't pronounce her name, which is how many nicknames begin. And it was given to her by the Umos Ha'olam. We're calling a major biblical figure, so the central character in the story of the Megillah, by a name that was not even given to her by the Jewish people. I mean, the truth is, it's not unprecedented. There is another major biblical figure who is known by a name that was given to him by a non-Jewish person. That, of course, is Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Moshe was so named by the Bas Paro, by the daughter of Paro, who found him, Ki min hamayim mishiseihu. In fact, in the old movie, this is a test of your age, in the old movie, The Ten Commandments, yeah, there's a line that didn't quite translate well. The line goes, and she called him Moses, for she drew him from the water. Shouldn't he have been called Drew? Right? Meaning that doesn't it makes it resonates much more in Hebrew, right? She called him Moshe, ki min hamayim mishiseihu, but she called him Moses because she drew him from the water. But Esther, okay, so Moshe's an exception. There's what to discuss about why Moshe was called Moshe. But we're calling Esther by a name that was given to her by non-Jews. So that is question number two. What are we to make of this whole discussion about this woman who, according to the majority opinion, her name was really Hadassah, and yet we insist on calling her Esther for some other reason, because she's like the moon or because she's very secretive. You know, why is it that we call her by a name that is not hers? And the third question. The Pasuk tells us, why do we call the name of the holiday Purim? Al kein karu liyamim ha'ele Purim al shem ha'pur. What is a pur? A lottery. How do you say a lottery in Hebrew? I'm glad someone said girl. I once gave this Torah and someone said lotto. No, that is, it's like when I was in yeshiva in Karen Biavne, the Rosh Yeshiva was speaking to us and he only spoke Hebrew and he said, Echom limba anglit banana. Like, okay, yeah, banana. So a lottery in Hebrew is a goral. So what does poor mean? So poor is a word that is likely of Persian origin. And we're using a Persian word to describe the holiday of the Jewish people. Why would we use a Persian? Why not call the holiday Goralot or Goral or even Lotto if you want? Right? It makes as much sense as Purim. And yet we call the holiday Purim based on a word. It's not even our word. So now we got through the three questions. Yeah? Question number one was, now we got to remember back to question number one. I don't even remember. Question number one was, why is there so much emphasis on drash, on Torah Baal Peh, on deeper levels of interpretation in Megillas Esther? Question number two, what is the story with Esther and the moon, or Esther because of the secrecy? Her name is Hadassah, just call her by her name. And question number three, the name of the holiday itself, the name of the holiday is Purim. Because of poor, it should be Goral, because that's really what Haman did when he drew the lots to determine, which by the way, even calling the holiday, we're not going to deal with this, but you have to ask the question, even calling the holiday based on a Goral, based on a drawing of lots, is a little bit odd also, no? Meaning, he was going to pull out a date, right? Meaning all the dates were in the hat. I don't know what he used, whether it was a hat or something, but everything was in the box. It wasn't like he put blanks in there, and like if he pulled out a blank, he'd say, I guess I'm not going to bother the Jews. You know, there was going to be a date where he was going to try to commit genocide. So like the fact that it came out, meaning why is that a significant event? But that's a question for a different time. So I'd like to share with you an idea that I saw in one of my favorite svarim, one of my favorite sefer on Chumash. It's a sefer called Be'er Yosef. Be'er Yosef was written by Rav Yosef Salant. There's not much information out there about Rav Yosef Salant, at least on Google, on the internet. They say that Rav Yosef Salant wrote his Sefer on Chumash. He was a mid-20th century rabbi in Israel, and he used to give public lectures. He used to give drashos on Parshas HaShavua, and those drashos were attended by none other than Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And the story goes, I'm not sure where it comes from, but the story goes that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach went over to him after he gave one of his drashos and said, you need to write this stuff down. This is really good. And because of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's advice, we have the Sefer Be'er Yosef. I used to teach in a boys' high school in Woodmere, New York, and I remember there was a particular young man that I used to learn with in the afternoons. He had a class where he was a one-on-one, maybe he was one-on-two, one-on-three, learning session with me. So we'd learn Gemara throughout the week, but on Thursdays, we'd learn Be'er Yosef together. And he told me afterwards that learning Be'er Yosef is what turned him on to learning. It's what got him excited about Torah. That it was just such an eye-opening experience, the depth of understanding and the clarity and the creativity in the Be'er Yosef's understanding, how he put everything together. So I'm going to share with you a comment that the Be'er Yosef has on the Megillah that answers all of our questions. In order to understand his comment, he says, we have to take a line of a Gemara in Megillah that seems to be telling us something very benign. It seems to be telling us about a conversation that doesn't really seem, it seems important, but it doesn't really seem substantive. The conversation goes as follows. Esther had a conversation with the Zakenim after the whole story was over. Keep in mind, the whole story of the Megillah is over. We always close the Megillah, and everyone lived happily ever after, except for Esther. She's stuck with that guy. Right? She's stuck with Achash. She's not living happily ever after. So Esther, imagine living in this palace with Achashverosh. Her whole life is ruined right now, but she got to save the Jewish people, and she saw the hand of God and how all of that happened. So she sends a message to the Zakenim. She sends a message to the Chachamim. Omer of Shmuel bar Yehuda, Shol Chalem Esther l'Chachamim. Esther sent a message to the Chachamim. Kivuni lidoros. I want you to write this story down. This belongs in Tanakh. This is a book that needs to be written. It's a story that needs to be told. If I die and this was a one-time event that no one's ever going to hear from again, that would be a tragedy. It needs to be heard. So how do they respond? Shalchula kina'at ma'oreras aleinu lebeinu umos. We can't. It's not like we just had geula and we are now under our own control and under our own jurisdiction and running our own country. We're still under the hand of Ahasuerus. We're still in Galus. If we start talking about a Jewish victory, if we start talking about the story that just happened, it's not going to be good for the Jews. We have to, when we're in Galus, we have to remember that we're in Galus. And we can't go taunting our enemies. You can go poking the bear, and the bear is going to be ferocious. Kina'at ma'oreres aleinu lebeinu umos. Esther gets that message. Shalcha lehem, she sends back to them. Kivar kesuva ani al divrei hayamim lemalchei madai paras. Don't worry about it. The story's already being told. It's in their history books. It's in their textbooks. It's there. The story's already being told. I just want it to be part of our story also. Meaning this was a significant enough event in their history that if you go into a fifth grade classroom in Paras and Madai and you open up chapter 24 of the history book, it will tell about the time that the evil Haman wanted to destroy the Jewish people, and thank God Ahasuerus helped and saved the Jewish people, and the Jewish people were not wiped out. We're there. It's there anyway. Just tell our story. What is happening in this conversation? So Rav Yosef Salant explains that if you really understand this conversation, something deeper is going on. What happened was, the real story, says Rav Yosef Salant, would be terribly embarrassing for Ahasuerus and for his entire Malchus. That all of this was happening under his nose, and it wasn't that it was happening under his nose, it's that he was driving the anti-Semitism. He was a driving force behind everything that was going on. It would have been such a black eye for Persia, and especially for the king. It would not help the Jews gain popularity. So Esther says, you're right, I agree. We can't write the story as it actually happened, with all of the details. We have to write it in a way that is most flattering to the king. We have to write it in a way that's not going to taunt the king. That's not going to taunt the kingdom. We have to write it in a way as if there was this one lunatic who was trying to wipe out the Jewish people, who was all acting on his own. It's never somebody acting on his own. Hitler wasn't alone. Stalin wasn't alone. It's never somebody acting on his own. There's always a support system. There are always people behind them. There's always somebody else. But if we tell the story as if there was one person acting on his own and he was doing everything, we could save the embarrassment. So Esther says, look in their textbooks. You know how in certain societies, the textbooks reflect not what actually happened, but what they want the children to believe happened. So they tell the story in a certain way. Right? You can go throughout the Arab world and see a very different story. Of the story of the Middle East than the story that we know to be true. There's an agenda sometimes. So Esther says, open up their textbooks. And you know what I want you to do, Chachamim? Write it like they would write it. How could you do that? So Esther says, because we have a secret weapon. And that secret weapon is called Torah Shebal Peh. Because we're going to give a Torah Shebichsav. We're going to give a framework of a story. We're going to give a basic skeleton of what happened. And then we're going to fill it in with an oral tradition, with Torah Shebal Peh. And words that may seem to be telling us one thing, or maybe a turn of phrase that's a little unusual, that will leave room for Chazal to come up with interpretation after interpretation that will fill in all of the blanks of the story. You know, when we think of who the villain of the Megillah was, right? There's no doubt. Who is the villain of the Megillah? Haman. You know, if you had to rank, who was worse? Haman, Achashverosh, Vashti. Right? Those are, let's say, the three evil people in the Megillah. Right? Haman, Achashverosh, Vashti. Who's the worst of all of them? No doubt it's Haman. Achashverosh and Vashti, okay, you can go either way. But Haman, by a far margin, was worse than anybody else. You know what the Gemara tells us? Not at all. I mean, he was evil, but Achashverosh was just as evil. Mashal da Achashverosh v'Haman, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Megillah, Mashal da Achashverosh v'Haman l'ma'ad avardome. If you want to understand the Achashverosh-Haman dynamic, we'll give you a mashal. L'shnei b'dei adam. Imagine you have two people. L'echad ha'ilo tel b'toch sadeu. One of them has a giant pile of dirt right in the middle of his field. And it's so annoying because he can't plow his field, he can't work his field, there's just this pile of dirt that's in the way. And he's going online on Craigslist, anyone want to cart away dirt? Who can I hire to cart away this pile of dirt? And the other guy, l'echad ha'ilo chritz b'toch sadeu. The other one has this huge crater, like a ditch in his field. And he also can't plow his field and he can't work his field because every time he goes, the ox falls right into the ditch and then it's over. And all he needs is dirt to fill in that ditch. And he's looking, where can I buy dirt? Where can I fill in this ditch? How can I? And each one is willing to pay. So both of these guys go to shul one day and they're bored during Chazaras Hashatz. So they strike up a conversation. I know it doesn't happen here, but they strike up a conversation and they say, oh, let's make it better. They go to a bar one day and they're each drowning out their sorrows in a drink. And one says, you look down, what's the matter? And he says, well, I got this pile of dirt and I can't find any carting company that's willing to take away my dirt. I'd be glad to pay for someone to take away my dirt. Why, you look down also. What's wrong with you? Well, I got this ditch in my field and I can't find anyone who's willing to fill it in, and light bulbs. And no one's got to pay anybody anything because it was a match made in heaven. You know, I have a guy in my shul who, for a living, he makes chairs. It could be these chairs originated with his company. I don't know. He does a lot of shuls. So I once had a shaila. Someone asked me, do you have to worry about shotness in chairs? So I said, I happen to know a guy who makes chairs. So I'll ask him if there's a shotness. I said, what is inside of a chair, in the cushioning of a chair? He said, it could be anything. I said, what do you mean it could be anything? You make it. What do you put inside? He said, no, the way it works is that there are factories that make all sorts of garments. And, you know, when they cut a garment, they have to cut all sorts of shapes to make a dress, a suit, or whatever they're making. And there are these offcuts. What are they going to do with these? The garbage. They can't do anything with it. So what do? They sell it to the chair factory. Everything is used. The chair factory needs some stuffing. This factory has extra cuts from the clothing that they cut. That's a match made in heaven. There you have cushions and mattresses. And that says the Gemara, was Achashverosh and Haman. Achashverosh and Haman were both eager to get rid of the Jewish people. And they happened to meet one day. You have a plan, I have the wherewithal, let's make it happen. And that's the real story of Achashverosh and Haman. In fact, his very name, Achashverosh's very name, is a symbol of his wickedness. The Gemara tells us he was Achiv Shel Rosh, which means he was an equal to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar. That's really bad. You know, that's Hitler Stalin bad. And Achashverosh was like that. Hushchru pneim shel Yisrael biyamav kishulei kedera. The faces of the Jewish people were blackened in his day, like the bottom of a pot. Kol shezochro amar ach l'rosho. Anyone who would even think of Achashverosh would say, oy vey. Like it engenders like this visceral reaction to hearing his name, like, ah. You know, like when you mention the name of the politician of the party that the person is not affiliated, right? Ah! In today's day and age. Hakol nasu roshin biyamav. Everyone became impoverished in his day. He was a genuinely bad person. He wanted to destroy the Jews. They couldn't record that in writing. That had to be passed down through tradition. That had to be passed down through the Torah Shebal Peh. And that's why the Megillah doesn't say that Haman identifies which nation he was asking to destroy. If you read the Megillah, Haman comes and says, I'd like to destroy a nation. I would like to commit genocide. And Achashverosh says, okay, sure. And then later on, he finds out, oh, it's the Jewish people? I had no idea. Does that story even make sense? You just give a blank check on genocide, you know? Hope it's not my people. Good luck. Obviously, he knew what was going on, but it couldn't say that. So it made it sound like he was duped into this whole plan that wasn't his at all. And that would explain this emphasis on the drash, on the Torah Shebal Peh, on what lies beneath the surface, would explain why, unlike in Kriyas HaTorah, what happens if you're in the middle of Kriyas HaMegillah and the Balkari is very fast and like your mind can't keep up with him? You ever go to a minyan like that? I get complaints every year. Balkari is too slow, Balkari is too fast. Balkari, you know, there's always a problem. It's never just right for everybody. And he's so fast, you missed a phrase. So what do you do? And you don't have a kosher Megillah in front of you. You just have a Chumash in front of you and you missed a phrase. What do? You read it in a Chumash. You don't even have a kosher Megillah. You could fill it in. You know what that's called when you're reading from a Chumash? That's called Baal Peh. You're not reading it from a Megillah. That's fine. And what about this coming Shabbos, Parsha Zachar? You missed Timcha Zechar Amalek, let's say. Go hear another Kriya. You can't just read it in the Chumash. For Kriya Satori, you correct everything. Poor Bar Mitzvah boy keeps mispronouncing the word and they keep correcting him, right? You got to correct it. I mean, with the Bar Mitzvah boy, maybe not for other reasons, but you got to correct it. You got to correct it. Because to read it Baal Peh, that's not Kriya Satori. Because the Megillah gives a little bit more room, even within the book itself, for a little Baal Peh. Unlike the Torah, when it comes to Kriyas HaMegillah, the Gemara tells us that your Yotzei, if you do Kriyas HaMegillah, l'loazos belaz. If you speak French, read a French translation of the Megillah. What? Can you do that with anything else? It doesn't seem that you could do that with Kriyas HaTorah. Because the words of the Megillah are not, in fact, the true story of the Megillah, the full story of the Megillah. They're a skeleton, they're a starting point of the story of the Megillah. And therefore, the words are not held to the same standard as other areas of Torah Shebichsav. I'll give you the biggest raya of all. The best proof that the Megillah specifically leaves out critical elements of the story. The best proof. I will argue, and you will all agree, I'm sure, that the most important character in the entire Megillah, by everyone's measure, the most important character in the entire Megillah does not appear in the Megillah even once. God himself. He's clearly the most important character in the Megillah. Does not appear once. What were they trying to tell us by leaving God out of the Megillah? That if he can be left out of the Megillah, what else is left out of the Megillah? What else do we need to look at that's not there? And with this, says the Be'er Yosef, we can answer all three questions we began with. The reason Rav Shlomo Alkavitz was opposed to any sort of explanation of the words without the benefit of Chazal, specifically by Megillah, is that Megillah was written with the intention that the true understanding of whatever is written can only come through the traditions of Chazal. And that is why Chazal spent 7 long dapim in Maseches Megillah, going through the Megillah's Pesukim, darshaning each one to demonstrate to us how critical those drushos are. The opinion that Esther's real name was Hadassah maintained that she was called Esther either because she was good at hiding things, you know, like the book of Esther, which hides so much, which doesn't reveal everything that's there, or because she reminded people of the moon. In you ask a child to draw a moon. What do they draw? A crescent. The moon's not a crescent. The moon is a ball. Why do they draw a crescent? Because that's the way the moon often appears. The moon hides more than it reveals sometimes. Sometimes it hides as much as it reveals. Sometimes it reveals everything. There are different elements. But that's unique to the moon. The sun doesn't do that. And therefore we call Esther, this is the Megillah of Esther, this is the Megillah of the moon. This is a Megillah that's concealing a lot. And the holiday, perhaps, is called Purim, by the Persian name, to stress that the way we celebrate this holiday, through the Kriyas HaMegillah, has been adjusted to fit with a Persian perspective. That the way that we commemorate the story, just keep in mind, you're reading a portion of the story. And that there's more to the story if you want to see it with all of its detail and with all of its magnificence from a Jewish perspective. And I was thinking, right, so now we're up to the message part. Good? Okay, are you with me? So I was thinking that maybe the Megillah serves as a prototype for many other situations and relationships in life. You see, we tend to be very good, and when I say we, I mean particularly the male we's, men, tend to be very good at when someone tells us they need something, that we respond to exactly what they tell us they need. Not quite as good at picking up on the nuances. You know, I asked the person, they looked a little bit down, so I said, hey, or I know they were going through some trauma, I said, how you guys doing? They said, we're fine. Okay, he said he's fine, so I guess everything is fine. That is how a man responds, right? Because I was told they're fine, and therefore it's fine. But very often in our interpersonal relationships, in order to really do good, in order to do good things, in order to be helpful people, we need to be able to see a little bit more than what's on the surface. We need to see that it's al shemes taher, that it's like the moon, that there's something being hidden. Just last week in my community, unfortunately, my neighbor is battling cancer, and he had a major surgery last week. Young family, young children. And someone called me up, another fellow in the shul, a dear friend of mine, called me up, said, just made a bar mitzvah this past Shabbos. The guy calls me Monday, he said, just made a bar mitzvah. I have all this leftover food from the bar mitzvah. Do you think it could be helpful to your neighbors? And I said, maybe. I forwarded the text to my neighbor. And you know what she said? We're okay. We'll be fine. What do you do with that? So I just said, you know what? I called back the fellow who made the bar mitzvah. I said, look, put together some food. Not all of it. Just because you feel guilty throwing it out doesn't mean you should give it to someone else to throw out. Not all of it. Put together some food, enough for like two nights of dinner. In for a family. And just drop it off. Don't ask any questions. Don't ask them if they need it. Just drop it off. And he did. And the next day I get a text from my neighbor. It was so sweet. So-and-so dropped off food by us. My kids loved it. They had such. But you were fine. You didn't eat anything. People don't want to bother other people. People always say, yeah, they'll say, I'm okay. It's okay. And sometimes you just have to pick up on nuances. And I understand, and I already referred to the fact that women tend to be much better at this than men are. And, you know, I'm not like pandering to women. This is like just, it's true. A dear friend of mine, Rabbi Larry Rothwax, sent me a link to a podcast from Rabbi Breidowitz from Or Sameach. And he said, listen to these 10 minutes of the podcast. It is the best explanation of the difference between men and women I've ever heard. So I said, okay. You got my attention, right? So Rabbi Breidowitz said that there was someone who was doing a study of the differences between men and women. And what they were trying to show that there's a lot of nature, it's not all nurture. So they took young children, and they asked these children, they gave a scenario, and they said, how would you respond to the following scenario? The scenario was that your brother is very ill, and he's going to die if he doesn't get a certain medication. The medication will cure him. The medication is only held at one pharmacy. Pharmacy closes at 7, you arrived at 7:30, and you see the medication right behind the window, but the door is locked, and your brother needs the medicine that night. What do you do? So every little boy said, you break the window, take the medicine, and give it to your brother. Good. Little girl said, first see if you can get a hold of the pharmacist. Maybe he could open the door. If you can't get a hold of the pharmacist, break the window, get the medicine. But leave a note that you're happy to pay for the window and that, you know, explaining the circumstances of what happened. And he was trying to explain that, you know, men tend to find the biggest problem and focus only on that and nothing else exists. Whereas women tend to be a little, this is what's called Bina Yesera, tend to be able to pick up on more, on the ramifications of that, on the nuances of the entirety of the situation. By the way, it's probably also what it means, daiton kalos. Kalos means that it floats from one place to another, that it's less focused on one topic, that it's more broad, it's more all over the place, and there's value to each. You know, the Gemara in Maseches Ksuba says that a particular Amora got very upset once because he used to give tzedakah very privately, very quietly, and he never wanted anyone to know who he was, who the giver was. So one time, the person who was on the receiving end, when he got his Tomchei Shabbos package, was waiting at the door to be able to, you know, to be able to see who the giver was. And he started chasing after him. And the guy didn't want to be found, so he started running away. And he and his wife were both running away from this person, the recipient of their kindness. And they had nowhere to turn at some point other than into a furnace. I don't know. Other than into like this hot furnace with coals on the... And they're standing in this furnace. They finally escaped to the person. They weren't caught. And the Amora's feet were burning. And his wife says, "Step on my feet, because I'm okay." And he said, "Why are you okay? I'm a tzaddik also. Like, how come you're zocha, that your feet..." So, I mean, obviously, women could touch the inside of an oven and nothing burns their hands. But, you know, but why are you okay? Why is it that you're zocha to that and I'm not zocha to that? And maybe the explanation is that as great as righteous and as wonderful as it is to give matan b'seser, his wife used to be around the house when the aniyim would come. She would be able to talk to them. She would be able to see the needs that weren't being expressed to her in a direct fashion. She'd be able to see what's hidden behind the story that's being presented to her. And that is where a person really becomes great. In communal work, in Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, communal work typically, the greatest community people, typically are not there to address needs that they were asked to address. It's to address needs that they noticed needed addressing. It's to deal with things that they've noticed, that they picked up. It's a sensitivity to people around you. It's an understanding of not just that the person near you just happens to be near you, but an understanding of what they are, who they are. You know, the way that God made us, it's an unbelievable thing. We never see ourselves unless we're looking in a mirror. We're always seeing other people. Right? Sometimes, you know, someone sees a photograph of themselves and they say, "Oh my gosh, I look so fat in that picture. I look so bald in that picture." I got news for you. Let me explain how a photograph works, right? Meaning, like, you're not used to seeing yourself. I'm not used to seeing myself. So, like, I'm surprised almost by how I look. I just grew a beard a few months ago. Like, sometimes I look in the mirror, I'm like, "When did I grow a beard?" Like, so it's not what I'm expecting when I look in the mirror. God made us to see other people all the time. We don't see ourselves. We see other people. But the question is, which glasses we're wearing? Are we looking to be able to see certain needs? Are we looking to be able to see how we can be helpful? And while I just met the Geller family, from what I understand, the impact that the Geller family has on this community and has for generations, and thank God all the generations seem to be staying here, the impact is one where they are community people. People who take care of the community. You know, Howard Geller was just described as a person who had a certain kind of smile, a certain kind of sparkle, a certain kind of charm. You know, the pasuk in Parshat Hazinu says that when the Torah comes down to the Jewish people, it's kirevivim alei esev. What does it mean, kirevivim alei esev? Kirevivim means like the delicate raindrops on grass. What does that mean exactly? Real rain helps the grass grow. The delicate raindrops, you know what it is? You ever go to a supermarket in the produce aisle and they spritz that, right? So like, why do they do that? Okay, to keep it fresh. I'm not convinced it's to keep it fresh. I'll tell you why. Because I walk down that produce aisle and I never in my life had a Yetzer Hara to buy dill or thyme or whatever. I don't even know how to put T-H-Y. I mean, but you see it sparkle. You see that little, those delicate raindrops. And there's a certain chain that it has. There's a certain sparkle, there's a certain charm. I heard from Ramosha Weinberger in the name of the Slonim Rebbe that sparkle and that charm comes from awareness of the other, from awareness of the community, from awareness of other people. And if you're able to say about your husband, your father, your grandfather, that he was kirvivim ale esef, that he had that special sparkle, that special charm, it's not an accident. We know where that charm comes from. It comes from an awareness of the other. It comes from an awareness and a sense of achrayus, a sense of responsibility for the community. What an amazing legacy that is. You should be zocha to keep on continuing that legacy and take the message of Megillas Esther, or this message of Megillas Esther, to always appreciate more than what's there on the surface, and to be able to help this community and all of Klal Yisrael.